So the bigger picture for rocks is actually that, you know, the thesis is transportation as we know it is broken. It's not going to scale to the next generations. You know, we have the climate crisis, we have the cities getting more and more crowded. It's just not working anymore. So we need a new kind of paradigm, and electrification and automation are technologies which could actually address those problems.
Hello and welcome to the Autonicast. I'm Kirsten Korosek, transportation editor at TechCrunch.
And I'm Alex Roy, founder of the Human Driving Association and co-founder of Johnson & Roy, the finest and most insightful strategic management advisory in transportation.
And I'm Ed Niedermeyer. I'm the author of Ludicrous, the Unvarnished Story of Tesla Motors. And I am quite excited about today's guest, and not just because the company has that he founded has an office in Portland, which is always an easy way to my heart as a hometown hero, but because it's this fascinating place. It's an area that people don't think about a lot, but it's really where two of the big sort of technological themes that we talk about in the show a lot sort of come together, which are electrification and automation. And so often we're way too focused on vehicles and what's happening on the vehicle side, but vehicles are part of broader systems, and particularly with electrification, how vehicles get charged is a huge issue. So our guest today is Chaim Bauman. He is the co-founder of Roxys, which is an automated charging company. I don't want to say too much because I'd much prefer him to explain to himself. But Chaim, welcome to the Autonicast.
Thank you very much for having me.
So we want to hear all about Roxys and what you're doing there. I've gotten to see, you know, these robots that you're building, but I want to start first with a little bit of your history. How did you get here? You know, you don't wake up and just say, I'm going to make robots that charge cars, right?
No,
I assume this is the journey that's taking you here. Tell us a little about that journey.
Yeah, absolutely. So I actually come from the electric vehicle space. I'm a serial entrepreneur now, officially. My first company was called Appion, and we were founded in 2005. And we were one of the world's first companies making fast chargers for electric cars. But we started way ahead of the cycle. So we started in 2005, first focusing on like airport vehicles and like logistic vehicles, like specialty vehicles. But in 2008-9, we heard rumors of Tesla and Nissan Leaf being launched, actually. So we started to develop a fast charger for cars. And when the Nissan Leaf actually arrived, the company really took off because we were like the first company to have a fast charger for that car. Some years after that, the company was acquired by ABB, a large multinational, still a big player in charging infrastructure. And I actually stuck around with ABB for 6.5 years as the head of the charging product line, which was a super nice adventure. And during that period, actually, sort of the nucleus of Roxys happened, because at some point we had a bit secretive customer in California, and they were not telling us what they were doing with the chargers. So they bought a bunch of fast chargers. So in my next trip to California, I actually decided to visit them. And I went to this like nondescript warehouse. There was no logo on the outside. And I went in, I met my contact person, so I knew I was in the right place. And then when I entered the warehouse, there were actually automated vehicles driving inside the warehouse. And this was 2017. So the robotaxi companies, they did not have permits for streets yet, or like very limited permits. So they were actually testing inside the warehouse. And I was, you know, this was the first time I saw an automated vehicle, and I was completely awestruck with it. It's like you immediately realize the impact to society it could have and how it could improve the society. But there was also a funny detail, because in the corner of the building, there was a man sitting behind a desk, and, you know, there was testing. And when the vehicle was done testing, he would walk out and plug in the vehicle. And I was just like, that's fascinating. So I asked him, so why are you doing that manually? Because the vehicle can drive itself. Why can't you charge them? Can the vehicle charge itself? And he's like, yeah. It's focus. The focus is to get the vehicle ready for the roads, and all the rest is later. So it just stuck with me, the story. So and then I still continued some time at ABB, and But in 2018, I decided I want to get back on an entrepreneurial adventure. And I left ABB and I met two of my co-founders who come from the robotics and the computer vision space. We started brainstorming, like, you know, could you solve this problem with robotics? And is there like a scalable way into the market which does not change the vehicle? Because that's a big hurdle. If you want to automate charging on a vehicle, changing the vehicle is really a tough sell to a car manufacturer. So can you actually do it without changing the vehicle? And that's sort of how the business plan got together. Like, I knew the market. I knew there's like, this is the direction and this technology will scale. And we also did quite a bit of due diligence on the idea, like, you know, if you build a robot at scale, can the cost go down? If you really build it at volume, and, you know, what are the technical hurdles, and are there like beachhead markets where we can enter? And yeah, we found, let's say, all the answers were positive, and we decided to found Roxys. So we are now focused on automating charging infrastructure. So the bigger picture for Roxys is actually that, you know, the thesis is transportation as we know it is broken. It's not going to scale to the next generations. The you know, we have the climate crisis, we have the cities getting more and more crowded. It's just not working anymore. So we need a new kind of paradigm, and electrification and automation are technologies which could actually address those problems. But charging is still a bottleneck. I was still remembering this first encounter with an AV company. So I was like, this will be huge. This needs, you know, all the billions of charging infrastructure going in the ground today are built for humans. So what if the future is not humans? So there needs to be some technology to unlock this potential and not throw away all the billions of charging infrastructure which went to the ground already. So that's sort of the start of Roxys, and now we're working on the future of charging infrastructure. There's a question, Alex.
Kein, how long before are you bound by a non-disclosure to keep that company a secret you went to visit, or can you tell us now?
But let's say it's one of the bigger self-driving companies still existing.
Okay, and so do you define, in your opinion, is Tesla a self-driving company?
Well, we will find out that on the date, right?
I think, but a wise answer.
So, let's say it's one of the companies in that space. Yes.
So, it's interesting to me that when you got into EV charging, it was kind of ahead of a market existing, and the same is now true again.
Yes.
With this company. To go back, I do want to get back into the company that you have now, but to go back to the first one, you mentioned you were initially working with more, it sounds like, commercial vehicles and charging around that. Why even get into that space at all? Because no one was really doing that. I know that once you heard about Nissan Leaf and the Tesla, things took off, but mm-hmm. go
that
back
years,
to the beginning.
That was years into yeah. it, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Why? What prompted even that interest to begin with, or even a sense that there would be a market?
Yeah. So first of all, the realization that this will happen, it's more a timing question than it is like a will it happen or not question. Let's say the thing which I really like about entrepreneurship is basically you have to basically put this dot on the horizon. And then the biggest challenge is to define like a from A to B to C kind of scenario, like where is there like an early beachhead market where you can already sell your technology, where you can actually learn and make money and fund your next development. So I knew that there were these markets. For example, there's the ports market where automated vehicles are already significant. Depending, it's a bit more Europe-Asia thing than US automated vehicles. Although, for example, Long Beach Container Terminal, they have one of the most advanced automated terminals. And in logistics, there's automated forklifts. They are already taking off in quite some numbers. So I knew that there were like these early markets, same actually as with Epion. We started from airport vehicles and like specialty vehicles, and then went into electric cars. And we're sort of doing the same again with Roxas, basically starting in the ports and logistic yards and then entering the robotaxi domain, basically.
What makes commercial use case, you know, because especially in the media side, you know, there's always so much focus, over-focused probably on the you know, consumer-facing use cases. And it makes sense, right? It's your audience is consumers. It's how they relate to this technology. And yet again and again, you know, we find that when these technologies start really becoming real, you know, they usually do so first. And both of these companies are great examples, I think, you know, sort of in a more commercial space, in a less consumer-facing space. What is it you think that kind of makes, you know, these sort of commercial use cases non-consumer facing use cases specifically, a good place to pilot these new technologies and these new kinds of, because they're user experiences too that are new that you're sort of figuring out.
Absolutely. Driver experience, mainly in the fleet domain, and also fleet manager experience, because, the main players in the behind the fence domain is the driver and the fleet manager. They have to like your solution. And if there's, of course, an automated vehicle, there's no driver. It's mainly like the fleet manager, the person responsible for the operation. But I think like the reason automated vehicles are already deployed in ports and logistics is that it's behind the fence type of application. So you're basically less or not subject to all kinds of regulations because it's private ground. So that makes the deployment much easier, and usually the use case is simpler. There are less lower number of actors. For example, logistic yards, it's just trailers and trucks and like a big space. And ports is the same. It's big vehicles. There are no children. There are no dogs and cats. There's no people with cones trying to block your vehicle or this kind of thing. So it's easier.
Is it easier to get partnerships too? Because right, I think like one of the really hard, everyone, you know, I think a lot of founders have this idea of like, oh, we're going to invent this thing. And then, you know, it'll go into a million cars a year when, you know, General Motors starts putting it on their cars. Well, yeah, it's, you know, car industry is a great way to build scale, but that's also makes it really, really hard to break into. Is that kind of one of the pieces of why sort of these non-consumer facing applications kind of have opportunities for startups?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say so. Also in the fleet vehicle domain, there is also like the scale is not that big. So the solution does not have to be like an industry-wide accepted type standard. And for, you know, mass deployment in the car domain, that's needed. But that's actually in the way because there is an IEC and ISO standard now for robotic charging, which will be ready early next year. And we have very actively worked on that standard together in a consortium. So I'm happy to be able to mention those names. So we're actually working with Porsche and BMW and Audi on the standard. So the cooperation is called Rock and Echo. That's actually a standardization project for basically providing input for the IEC and ISO standard. And that consortium drives the standard. And the last 2 years, we've been working with those car brands on the standard. And that will really pave the way to car adoption. That's a longer route. For the logistics, we can deploy today because it's really about keeping the fleet manager happy. The fleet manager has a job to run their operation, need to deliver goods or make sure containers are offloaded, etc. And you know, any solution which make that process more efficient or better is welcomed usually. That's more a pragmatic market. But of course, for the scale, we need to enter more automotive applications. Also, the robotaxi. I think a robotaxi is actually pretty amazing still how fast it's developing because it's extremely complex technical challenge, but also regulatory challenge, and also often forgotten. And I think now often in the media is like public acceptance. You know, will people accept this solution? I think it's a very complex landscape to navigate, but it seems, considering the complexity, it's moving at pretty high pace, actually.
Kirsten, Do you have a question or can I go,
in? Go, please jump in.
All right, in the early days, when you first began doing this, the first decision had to be, I guess, how exactly, or from a technical engineering standpoint, how would the charger connect to the vehicle? Can you walk us through the hardware you selected and then the work you did in machine learning to ensure accuracy of connection and then the software?
Yeah, so absolutely. So basically so we built robots from the ground up. We initially started looking at like off-the-shelf robots, but they are very expensive and usually they're not built for outside. So they're built for indoors applications. So we decided early on that we would focus on purpose-built robots, which become, let's say, attractive in price if you build them at scale. And one of my co-founders, he has a background in, so Joost, his background is in biomechanical robots. So it's exoskeleton, the Boston Dynamics type stuff. And we are using the principles from those biomechanical robots. Therefore we can build robots with relatively off-the-shelf parts, which are low cost at scale. So how the principle works, it's actually like a person plugging in. So you would navigate based on your eyes where to go. So we use computer vision to understand where you need to go, where you need to move. The charge port is identified with computer vision by training an algorithm to exactly know where to go. And then we use the tactile feedback mechanism, just like if you would insert a plug in and out in a socket. You more or less aim for the right place, and then you feel if you're right, and if you're right, you push the plug in. And that's exactly how the robot works. So basically, computer vision for navigating, then a little bit of feedback on the last bit when you're correctly positioned, and then basically exerting the force. So it's very much working like a human hand. It sounds very simple. The technology is quite complex. It's a typical AI application where you need lots of data, lots of experimentation to get it right. But it's working now.
What approaches didn't you take for this? Right, because I think sometimes it's helpful to understand sort of like what are the ideas, right? Because there's a million ways, right? You could, in theory, have a humanoid robot that unplugs, right? That just replaces a human one to one. There's, soft robot. There's all kinds of different ways, in theory, you could plug on the bottom of the car. There's lots of different. What approaches did you look at, or maybe one in particular that you rejected?
Yeah. I think I like your question. What did you not do? So we basically decided we can't change the vehicle, because if you make changes to the vehicle. Big changes, like for example, doing something under the vehicle, it's going to be a very tough go to market, because you basically need to convince car makers to change their vehicles, which in logistics space may happen in some type of applications, but for cars it's very difficult. And then basically you need a unifying standard to change vehicles with all OEMs. So in my charging infrastructure background, I've been part of the current standards for connectors. And it took like 10 years to get to sort of a status quo. And now in North America with NACS coming, there is a change, which also take years probably to mature. So to convince all car makers to change their vehicles is just very tough. So we basically said we cannot change the car. And we need a way to leverage existing charging infrastructure. So we do not integrate with the charger. Basically, the world is designed for people. So we're just doing the job of the person and not changing the charger, not changing the vehicle, because that allows us to go to market now, basically, without like big hurdles. And that was like, so some of the engineers sometimes tried, there was quite a bit of opposition, for example, not to integrate with the charger, because it makes the technical challenge much simpler, because these fast charging cables, they are very heavy and difficult to maneuver. So if we would integrate that into the robot, basically it's easier, but it would basically create a hurdle for the customer to you need to work then with certain charger brands, et cetera, and everybody has their preference. And you cannot apply a retrofit scenario, because today there's billions of infrastructure going into the ground. So at some point you would need a retrofit solution. So basically we said we do not integrate with the vehicle and we do not integrate with the charger. And that's sort of the basic principles. We had to develop, for example, one of the big technical challenges was to handle these very heavy cables, these fast charging cables, which are not easy to handle. And in combination with the requirement not to make a very expensive robot, which is very strong. Basically.
So if I...
A question about the design. Sorry, Alex, but I want to jump in. Do you foresee a time where you will change that underlying ethos, which is to not completely integrate and more be a bit agnostic around the infrastructure? Or is this a central principle that you think that will always be the case within the company? Because as you mentioned, there is a benefit to being more integrated, but the downside is if the charging infrastructure changes, then you're starting all over again. Yeah. So do you foresee that ever changing, or is it just like, it's early now, so we're going to see how this shakes out?
I think like over time, this could change. I mean, the main reason for starting the company like that is that the go-to-market is very simple. So you know, the big problem, for example, for a solution which would change the vehicle would basically, you know, you probably have to spend a couple of years of business development to convince vehicle makers to make changes. And then you are not on the learning curve, and you're also not on the revenue curve. So basically, how can we make the boundaries for the go-to-market as low as possible? That was basically the first principle. And maybe that changes over time. As the market becomes bigger, maybe over time that could change. But at the moment, we're still operating according to that principle. And it's working really well. It's actually one of the reasons people like our solution. Because, for example, now we are in all kinds of ports projects in the U.S. with the big funding from EPA, and some of those customers already have bought chargers. So basically, we can just use the chargers they already bought, and that's a very big benefit from a customer perspective. It's a slightly higher degree of difficulty on the technical side, but yeah, it's a big customer benefit. But you know, yeah, like in any young company, you have to just every year reevaluate if the principles are still okay, I would say. So
great. We haven't got to talk about the cost of these units, but at what point or what is the timeline for a commercial customer to see this become like a net positive? Because the investment in the units is X, and the savings is Y. What is the timeline look like?
In the fleet domain, every use case is a bit unique, right? So for the automated vehicle customers, usually it's very simple. The whole case is built around automation, not having people on site. So it's black and white. We are not budgeting for people. So charging needs to be automated. So it's basically, it's a bit black and white. And then sometimes there is like a business case, which we see in ports. It's about safety and work rules, etc. And also we see this in yard automation. Safety is a big thing there. So I would say sometimes there is a case really like calculating on person hours, but charging is a small task. It's a small job, but a very big responsibility, because if it's not done correctly, the fleet is not working. It's often more the intangible factors or the automated vehicle factors which are the decision for doing it or not, basically. And the calculation example, there are not that many customers who are really doing this math. It's just like, does it actually make my life easier? And does it, because the most money is earned on the road with most of our customers. It's about, you know, delivering goods, offloading containers, etc. Anything which makes this process more efficient or reliable is just a big benefit.
So, this yard automation example is really interesting, because, you know, there's a number of companies that have made these huge commitments to electrification. Right. And these aren't necessarily automated vehicles, or maybe, you know, and what's interesting is that a lot of that electrification, the challenge that seems to maybe was, you know, people knew it would be sort of upfront cost and, you know, priming the pump on the industry side. There are a lot of challenges to moving a big, you know, for example, Amazon scale fleet to all electric, a big example. And but the charging one, right? You know, again, with you think about fleet management, there's this whole art and science of fleet management that has completely evolved around gas and internal combustion, or, you know, for a long time. Is that one of the use cases, like the opportunity to scale an electric fleet without getting into a lot of really complex, like figuring out the management, managing people, hiring people, scaling your workforce to do things that are relatively simple, like unplug a car, plug a car. And then, you know, we see yard automation, you know, maybe, you know, they need a human driver on the street, but, you know, you can drive itself from the charger to the maintenance spot or something, right? How big is this sort of electrification fleet part of your business right now and growth opportunity?
So that challenge is really there. So the difference with fueling scenarios, that fueling takes a few minutes and charging, especially in like this big fleet vehicles, takes at least 30 minutes or 1 to 2 hours. So it basically, the customer has to change their process already, because, you know, fueling can be done in a serial manner. You can just fuel one vehicle after the other. But if charging takes 30 minutes or 1 hour, you cannot do it. So what happens then is basically, instead of centralized fueling point, charging becomes distributed and distributed over the whole facility. So basically, it's all over the place and it becomes very difficult to manage. So that's actually where we are in discussion with many of the big fleets. It's like, they see this challenge because it went from a centralized to a decentralized task, which now may be handled by the drivers. So, and, you know, in a small fleet, maybe with 3 or 4 vehicles, you know, the drivers are very motivated. They care for their job. But if you operate a 1,000 vehicle fleet, the driver, you know, the drivers may rotate. There's quite a high rotation sometimes in some fleets. So, you know, to make sure the process runs efficiently, that's a big hurdle. So it's often about, you know, developing a concept which is ideal for the customer operation. The same is true, by the way, for robotaxi. So in the last year, we have worked very deeply with all of the robotaxi players in North America, but also in China. And so there's been a lot of emphasis on the vehicles all the time, but now how do you actually deploy this operation at scale? And now the infrastructure piece comes into play. So you need these charging hubs. I think everybody's seen the Waymo charging hub in San Francisco. It's a huge operation. Basically, you have washing, cleaning, charging, calibration. All this stuff needs to happen in a big hub. But if you would try to tackle a city like LA with big hubs, that's a huge, huge challenge, because building such a hub, I come from the infrastructure side. So building like a 100-stall or a 50-stall charging hub, you need utility power to come in. You need permits. You need the land. It's like a 3-4 year project minimum. So, you know, if you want to scale robotaxis in a city like LA, big hubs, it's going to take you years to develop. So we are thinking, like, can you actually address this problem in a different way? Because if you look from, so first of all, big hubs are difficult to build. The other problem is transit time. So if you are, you know, operating a robotaxi service in a certain area, every time you need to charge, you need to go to the other side of the city to charge. Basically, you can be stuck in rush hour traffic maybe for an hour. So an hour could be $100 worth of revenue. So all this transit time. So actually, big hubs are difficult to build. And you want to create, actually, probably you want to create a fine-grained distributed model where you eliminate this transit time. So, but of course, so how can you... So reasoning from the ground up, what a robotaxi company actually needs is a fine-grained network where you eliminate transit time and have maximum flexibility to pick up that great ride. You know, there can be a fantastic ride just around the corner, and then you know there's going to be a charging on the route somewhere. But of course, with big hubs, you can have people. But if you want to build a fine-grained network of small hubs are much easier to build because you don't need these megawatts of utility power. There are much more places where you know, you would have the land available, permits are less difficult. So you can quickly build that. But of course, you cannot have people there if you have like a four-stall site. So from our concept, we are basically in discussion with all of the robotaxi companies. So what if you build a fine-grained network or maybe even leverage existing charging sites? So if there's already a 10-stall site, maybe you can make two automated slots and 8 slots which are just for people. This allows companies to scale much faster and create a service which is actually delivering much more value to their business proposition by having this fine-grained network. So,
yeah, you said you've been working closely with all the robotaxi companies. So have you been able to bring them around to your point of view that this fine mesh network is better than the giant hub? Because right now we're seeing the giant hub. So maybe you can talk a little bit about, like, have you been able to convince them to kind of go this other way?
It's probably not going to be another way. It's going to be additional. So it's going to be one or two, because you still have the washing, cleaning, calibration. So basically, it's probably going to be a mix of like 2-3 big hubs per city, and then smaller deployments. Because let's say the challenge for a robotaxi company is also, you know, at some point you get a permit for a certain city. But it's uncertain till the last moment. Now you get this permit. Now you want to scale. But now you have to build these big hubs, which take 3-4 years. So you have the permit, but you cannot deploy because your operation is not ready for it. So have we got them around this topic? I would say yes, but it will take some time before this becomes visible in the market, I think. But I think we're getting there. I think we're getting there. Yeah. The idea was not necessarily our idea. It's sort of in all the conversations we had that the idea emerged and basically stuck with all of them. So
is the next step on the robotaxi side to basically get a pilot going where you can not just within these large hubs, but this smaller scale example? Or maybe you already have pilots going on that we're just not aware of.
We do. Let's say we have no public pilots at the moment, so none that I can speak to. No.
But that would be the next step that you're going
absolutely
towards. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And so it's going to be I think this is going to be a fascinating year for the robotaxi, also with the Tesla announcement. But also, I think, like, watch the Chinese players. There's a lot going on. Baidu, WeRide, AutoX, maybe not visible in North America today, but, you know, there's the momentum for self-driving in China is really, really strong. So
are you working in China then? Or is that an area that you are wanting?
We are not in China, but we are definitely in talks with the Chinese OEMs, because I think, like, so I'm based in Europe. Europe is really behind on self-driving technology, I would say, at least at the robotaxi case. But I think this is going to be a China-US play. You know, who's going to get there first? I strongly have the feeling. And also the billions going into that market, both on the US and China side, I think that's going to be the battleground, I think. Who's going to get there first?
All right, wild card question that Ed is going to hate. All right. So I'm a longtime EV owner. I've had multiple Teslas. I've wanted to buy other things, but that's for another episode. How long before we might see a consumer product that could be installed in my home?
Okay. I would say about 3 years from now. So it's definitely on the roadmap, and we actually have customer requests for that. Because from a vehicle, so the question is, can you get to $1,000 robot at scale, right? And the answer is yes, but you need to scale. So we're definitely working on that. So I would say 3 years.
So, but why would a consumer want that? Like, well, isn't a consumer, it just easy to plug?
You've answered the question, Kirsten. No consumer needs it. No consumer needs it. However,
convenience consumers is its own reward. Want it.
And and as now that I've moved to a state in which you reside, look around at our neighbors and ask yourself, will they not hemorrhage cash on convenience? Yes.
Honestly, my neighbor just bought a Rivian, actually. I don't live in a particularly nice neighborhood, but they bought a Rivian, and I think they keep forgetting to plug it in. I never see it plug in. And I know, like, part of it is that people just buy, you know, these really long range cars, worried about the use case and normal day-to-day driving. They don't need to charge anywhere near as much as they thought they would. But I'm curious on the scale piece of this, is it just a question of, like, finding the demand, right? Because you mentioned earlier that, right, obviously cost and scale go hand in hand in any kind of hardware business. Do you feel – but at the same time, right, when you're making new things, you know, you learn as you're doing it and you have to do iterative design. Is there a lot more iteration and learning and on the design side to be done before you – sort of really try and hit that scale? Are you trying to just hit that scale right now with the current generation of hardware? Sort of talk about that relationship between the design development process and you know, your goals for achieving scale.
Yeah, so basically it's a trickle down. So basically you start from, like, the ports and logistic use case where the scale is medium, but you provide, like, hard business value, and therefore the product can be slightly more expensive. And then the other extreme is the convenience case, the consumer. It's a combination of all things. So it's the learnings you have, like, what are the requirements on the product that are strictly necessary, and what are the requirements which are, you know, you learn over time what you can eliminate, basically. It's the scale, so the trust with suppliers, if you're talking about 100,000 volume, there's a whole different category of suppliers who are all of a sudden interested talking to you. But if you're talking about 100 units, you know, these suppliers will not even pick up the phone. So that factor is in there. Technology learnings, it's basically, so from a technology perspective, what I can speak to is that we're basically trying to, so what makes a robot expensive is accuracy. So if you want to create a robot which is super accurate, super repeatable movement, that's expensive. But if you basically find a way to let AI and software basically compensate for inaccuracy of the hardware, you can actually build a inaccurate robot which is compensated for by the software. So that's sort of the development direction. So it's a combination of learning, leverage with suppliers, having the customer which actually commits to 100,000 plus volume. Basically, that's the combination. So that's that will take some time. But I already spoke about the Rock and Acre project where we are developing those standards. There are four car brands in there. So they're not in there for, just out of pure fun, or there's a business reason they are doing this consortium. So I would say from a premium car buyer perspective, automated charging is a very attractive proposition, because now you're buying this $150,000 Mercedes. And then, you know, charging feels a bit like so-so, especially the fast charging experience at public fast chargers. But also, let's say, home garage charging. These vehicles will all come with automated parking functions in the next years. So it's convenience. And of course, for us, also very interesting to follow the automated parking, automated valet parking, automated valet driving. There's a whole suite of solutions being developed by the premium OEMs. So that make the necessity for automated charging clear, basically.
So this may be where the standard that you've been talking about comes in, but just thinking through sort of, you know, what it means to automate charging and you know, without touching the vehicle side of it, right? Like, and I've seen your robots in action. It's quite fascinating. There's a human-like aspect to, as you described, you know, it's sort of with just like a charger, you sort of match it up and then you kind of push it in, and it's really fascinating to watch. The one piece I didn't see in the demo that I saw, and that I just am curious about, is, you know, charge port covers. Right. If you want a fully, you know, no human in the loop charging experience and you're not doing anything on the, well, so, I mean, like a vehicle will have, right. Like there's a button that the driver can put. So I'm just curious what is the role of the human in just opening the cover? Cause once the cover's open, I've seen it. I believe your robot can do it. But how does that piece get done in an automated fashion?
So the ideal scenario is indeed like an automated charge port cover, like any Tesla has already since 2012, I would say, or so. And I think all the other manufacturers are going that route, automated charge port covers. And that's also part of the IEC and ISO standard. So basically the IEC and ISO standard is not a technically complex standard. It's about opening and closing the charge port and a trigger signal for plugging in, plugging out. That's roughly the standard. Or engineers will probably kill me for leaving out some of the details, but you know, that's more or less it. Indeed, like at least the premium brands are all going for automated covers, as Tesla already has it since. I think the first Model S already had the automated charge port cover. So
in theory, the car would signal via like Bluetooth, something wirelessly, as when it pulls up to the port, and then it would trigger that on. Okay, great. Yeah, that's okay. I thought.
Yeah, the standard is Bluetooth according to Car Connectivity Consortium spec. But yeah.
Go ahead, okay. Alex.
All right, so there's a history. This is going to make Ed very happy. There's a history of companies sometimes over automating, and then there's a failure on the production line, and then the whole line is paralyzed until that machine is repaired or comes out. Absolutely. In some cases, all the machines have to come out, and people have to get back in there. So. As I'm currently working with some clients who are in warehouse robotics, and there's the debate amongst warehouse robotics companies. One of the terms I heard recently was minimum work condition, which is like minimum risk condition for an AV that has an issue. Mm-hmm. So your machine, I'm looking at the animation on your website. Since your machine sits in between the charger and the car, it's completely separated except for, I guess, the charging handle fits into your device. If you have a failure, how easy is it to remove the charging cable from your machine such that the processes of charging vehicles can continue until a Roxas bot is fixed?
Yeah, so that's been taken into account from day one. So there's a quick release on the connector. You can basically, in less than a minute, detach the connector and switch to manual operation. But actually, over the last years, we've made that much more elegant. So basically, the robot is a smart device. So first, the robot will try to plug in a couple of times. And the robot will not attempt the identical move. So the robot can actually learn and try different angle. So the robot can experiment a bit. If that doesn't work, we can switch, like an AV, we can switch to teleoperation. So basically a remote operator can actually support the system. If that doesn't work, worst case, you switch to manual operation. You basically detach the connector and then switch to manual until somebody goes on site and fixes the machine. So indeed, so some of our customers today are ports, and it's a very critical process. So so usually it's a combination of at least build a little bit of redundancy. So if you need 10 robots, okay, buy 11, then a little bit of redundancy there, a good remote support solution, and then worst case, switch to manual operation. But that's the last resort, basically.
So we've covered all the present day stuff. And since we're approaching the witching hour, I thought I would look way ahead. And so I'm wondering if the company has certainly talked about, you know, their commercial approach and then potentially robotaxis and then also, you know, really pushing for these smaller hubs and how that would all work. Have you talked at all about using the robotics and the technology you've developed in other ways beyond charging? Because there's all sorts of other pieces on the robotaxi front where they've talked about using people potentially, but I wonder if things like maintenance or cleaning could also be automated and your company could use that technology in those areas as well.
Well, there are other use cases where we are actually looking into. One of the use cases is standby power in a yard automation scenario. So some applications require standby power. That's what we're looking into. I'm not sure how much I can say about that. So we're actually working with a very large company in North America on this. So we haven't looked at like a service robot approach with cleaning the vehicles, etc. So for now, we stick to basically connecting power to vehicles. But let's say there's a big variety. Also, the forklift use case is a different connector. It's different. We have the CCS1 connector and soon next connector for the more yard vehicles and port vehicles and cars. And then there are some standby power applications where that's also a different connector, but still it's more or less the same use case, connecting power to vehicles.
So my last question that I just have to ask before we let you go is sort of where do you see... And then it's a little bit tangential to the core of what you do, but you've been in the charging business for so long, I have to ask, where do you see sort of the various standards going? I mean, the move here in North America towards NACS is sort of, it kind of felt like it came out of, I mean, I know it was sort of, there's a lot going on behind the scenes. It felt publicly like it kind of came out of nowhere. And then all of a sudden everyone just sort of switched over. You know, CHAdeMO seems like it's basically gone now. CCS. Mm-hmm. So is everything going to go to NACS? Is CCS around for the, do we need a new standard sort of long-term for the future? What are your thoughts on that before we wrap up here?
So I was also a bit surprised about the, at least big media support for NACS. But I've also learned in the last 18 years in charging infrastructure, give me the vehicle first and then we'll see if it's real, because there's been a lot of PowerPoint and a lot of media in the EV space. So although there's quite a bit of media support, we are working with quite a few vehicle OEMs who are very serious on their development programs with NACS. So I think NACS will definitely come, but phasing out, it will not be an overnight phase out, because there's thousands and thousands of chargers deployed with CCS. So I think it's going to be like a 5 to 10 year transition, at least I would say. But it seems NACS is here to stay. Although I think Tesla did a nice job on the connector. It was also good that their CCS, because the market really took off, the EV market, because there's a standard. As being in the space this long, I was surprised. I didn't think there would be a change. But I think in the North America, and Tesla just did a really good job building a charging infrastructure, which is actually liked by people. So I think that's a very, very important factor that you know, something which works in the end will win. I think it's a surprising move, but I think it will happen. Absolutely.
Amazing how that works, right? When something works, people use it and it's successful.
Yeah, something along the lines of convenience, maybe.
Great. Well, this has been an absolutely fascinating conversation. Karen, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today.
Okay. Thank you very much for inviting me, and thanks for the nice conversation.
Yeah. And thank you to all of our listeners for listening to yet another episode of the Autonicast.